He is Robin Leach. He is Jada Markin.
This is Car Keys.
Hello to our listeners for this week's show of Car Keys with Robin Leach and Jay DeMarkin. I'd like to start off this week's show for our listeners talking about a few things that have come to me in Motor Trend's daily emails of various topics which they like to talk about. And today's topic is, the first topic is an EV that Ford is producing for the European market and not the American market, but they seem to think it's pretty good. It's also in combination with VW because they use VW's platforms and probably other things similar to the VW's EVs. And it's called the Capri. And those of us who are old enough to remember the Capri of yesteryear, it used to be, a two-door sort of a sports car. Jay remembers it, I'm sure, and will comment. Gasoline and all that. But it's been Ford nameplate that's been sitting in the archives, I guess, waiting for some car for Ford to produce that maybe deserves the Capri name again. Anyways, it's an electric EV, so far only available in Europe, and I guess it joins an electric version of the Explorer, which I guess is on the market in Europe, which I have not yet knowingly seen in my recent trip to Europe. Jay may have, but those are European vehicles not yet here in the United States. We'll end that on that topic. The next topic on MT's Motor Trends list of things that they put out recently are their 12 best of the all-wheel drive vehicles available, mostly, I guess, in the U.S., but also some of them may be in Europe. I don't want to belabor it.
Before you move on there, let's go back to the Capri for a second.
Okay.
So I have to say I don't quite understand Ford's marketing strategy here.
With names?
You know, the Capri in Europe was a little bit what the Mustang was to the U.S. market. And I know we had Capris here for a short while, and Ford has done that every so often. They bring in the European model that they sell in the U.S. The Capri was one of them. But in Europe, there were a lot more Capris than there ever were here, and there were a lot of different models they put in. When the car came out in the early 70s, even maybe late 60s, it came out with a broad range of engines, and they had an engine that was a four-cylinder 1300cc, then a 1500cc, then they had a 1700cc, then they had two-liter engines. They had a small V6 and an inline four. Then they had a 2.3 V6 and then even a 2.6 and 2.8, and later on a 3-liter. So it was kind of crazy to think of the number of different engines they had in the same car, and it was a little like the Mustang. It was meant to look more like a sports car than it really was in most of the different models. And it was also campaigned as a very successful race car. 2.6, the 2600 RS comes to mind. So it's got great history, the model name, and I just don't understand what Ford is doing. They did this with the Mustang Mach-E here in this country, and it doesn't seem to be a success. Ford's electrification is not really very successful across the line. And to go ahead and do this Capri in Europe, I personally don't get it. But, you know, I've been wrong before.
Well, I will comment also on the Capri being the car that it's going to be. Apparently, Motor Trend's opinion of its looks is that it looks better than the VW ID4. Which means, to me, doesn't look like anything like the Capri of the past, which you've just been discussing, Jay. The other part of it is that, Ford's current Mach-E was a derivative of the Mustang, which has been somewhat controversial, probably, in some of our opinions of why did they name the Mach-E Mustang other than the badging. A Mustang-type vehicle, alternative to the real Mustang, which we all know, and I think we still love. And that's all gasoline, and very much a wonderfully looking car. But I wanted to move on to the next top list of Motor Trend's topics and recent emails. And they are coming out. You know, one comment about Motor Trend, which, Jay, I'd like you to chime in on, is Motor Trend has gone mostly digital and in email versions of its formerly monthly magazine on cars. And as I told you, Jay, when I handed over my version, the paper version of the issue that you have in your hands, it was very pleasurable to have that issue in paper form again. It's a quarterly. I think Motor Trend's going to come out with this in a quarterly fashion, and in between the quarterly fashion, there will be daily, almost daily, articles that they are producing much more quickly than the lead time necessary, as we all know, in the old way of monthly issues in print. But back to it, the next topic was MT's, Motor Trend's, top 12 best of the all-wheel drive cars currently available in the United States, and there are a lot more than 12. How they came up to this this list, Jay, you may want to comment, but it starts out with number 12, the Toyota Corolla GR, which is a $40,000 plus $40,000 base price and has a turbo i3. I'm just going to run down the list, and then you can comment. Number 11 was Tesla Model S, apparently base priced at only $76,630, all electric. That's the biggest model they put out. Number 10 was Tesla Model 3, starting around $49,130. 9 was Porsche 911 Carrera 4 GTS at $174,695 plus. Number 8 is a Genesis G90. 3.5T, that's related to the engine size, gasoline, $90,450. Number 7 is the Mercedes-Benz E-Class, starting around $63,450 with a turbo i4 engine in it. Number 6 is the Lucid Touring vehicle at $73,150 as an EV. 5 was Audi A5, starting around $47,295 with a 2.4 turbo. Audi A6 was number 4, the all-road version, $70,400 with a V6 turbo. Number 3 was the BMW 2 Series Coupe, $41,800 with a turbo i4 in it. Number 2 was the Toyota Prius LE all-wheel drive, $30,445 plus, with 53 to 54 mpg, I think that's the mileage king in the car, the combustion engine line of vehicles available. And number 1 came out to be the Hyundai Ioniq EV at $43,600.
Okay, I was very patient, and I let you go
through
the list.
Yes, you were. Thank you.
I did not know the list, but to me, this list makes makes no sense. It's just
no sense. I agree with you, Jay.
It's just a bunch of different models that have nothing to do with one another. There's no comparison. And to be fair, most cars these days come in a lot of cars. Most cars, I think, come in all-wheel drive form.
And are never used off-road.
Standard or snow. Optional. So the list makes no sense. I mean, you know, Prius, a 911... electric cars, gasoline-powered cars. But, okay, if that's the list, that's pretty much, you know, a variant of all the cars on the market.
I would agree. I think it makes no sense. Also, it does not take into effect. I don't know what. I suspect that all-wheel drive vehicles are pretty much similar in their performance capabilities in unsatisfactory weather, meaning snowstorms, mud, and...
Can I go on a little tangent here?
Yep.
I've been thinking about, you know, we have these discussions about electric vehicles and the range, and we have most electric vehicles have, you know, more than one motor if they're going to be all-wheel drive. And,
right.
You know, the motor sits right near the wheels and power the wheels. There's very little, there's no drive shafts on electric vehicles, right? Unlike
correct.
gasoline or diesel-powered cars, where you have an engine that's either placed in the front or in the back or in the middle, and then drive shafts to drive either the front and or the rear wheels. So electric motors, electric cars, you know, either drive, most of them actually drive the rear wheels. And I guess back in the 80s, we all started to think that front drive cars were more efficient and handled better than rear wheel drive cars. And then we went to all-wheel drive. But, you know, the reality is the more weight you have on the propelling wheels, the better traction you're going to have. So, for instance, in a Porsche 911, it's a rear-wheel drive, but the engine sits way in the back. There is a lot of traction on those rear wheels. So I think with electric cars, we're kind of obsessing about all-wheel drive, when the reality is that the base models that come in two-wheel drive, usually rear-wheel drive, are probably quite efficient, including in inclement weather, whether it be rain or even snow.
Point of information on that, to interrupt quickly, the tires can make all the difference in that comment.
Yeah, but the tires,
for two-wheel drive, rear-wheel drive, or even two-wheel drive, front-wheel drive vehicles.
If you don't have the right
tread compound, I won't say that the Porsche 911 two-wheel drive is going to be very effective in snow, even though it's fairly weighty in the rear end. Most of the time, those cars come with performance tires, which are useless in snow.
I get that. Tires are a very important factor, right? We know that. And I guess as we get closer to winter, maybe we'll try to find people in our neck of the woods who have two-wheel drive electric vehicles. And I think I know a few. And I'd like to test drive a two-wheel drive electric vehicle in the snow and see.
Well, that may be true for electric, but the tires are also, I think, instrumentally important in that to be effective.
For example, my Hyundai Sonata,
which is a hybrid front-wheel drive car, so it's partially electric at some point, I consider, and I've driven it lots of time in snow, I have what they call all-season tires on it, and the tread is not overly aggressive for grabbing snow in slippery conditions or icy conditions.
I'm trying not to go on a tangent about tires and traction in the winter. What I'm trying to say, basically, is that we're overlooking base models in electric vehicles.
This was a Motor Trend thing, and I didn't want to dissect that. And other than you're now expanding on the topic, so you can continue to do that. But this was just a 12 car list that, as you said, is sort of meaningless that Motor Trend put out, and I have another. Multi-time 12-point list on another subtopic, which I'd like to get to eventually. Okay, and you probably have the same comments about that. But continue what you want to do about the two-wheel drive situation.
Well, that was what I was trying to say. That's my point. Is electric vehicles? We should consider the base models two-wheel drives, whether it's with Kia, Hyundai. I just read a test drive of the BMW. The new i5, so the 5 Series electric version, and they were saying the two-wheel drive base model electric 5 Series is very quick, and again, we don't know what the traction is, but it's certainly quick enough for most and has a decent range. So, that was my point.
Well, that could be, you're alleging the cars in quick acceleration and handling and that kind of thing, and that's fine. Shall we move on to my next topic to Motor Trends before we give you the mic?
I can't wait.
Okay, well, the other list is a list of best, in their opinion, Motor Trends' opinion, not ours, best three-row SUVs with captain seats. Now, these are the huge models, and Not many of us, and probably not many of our listeners who have these are probably listening to our show. But anyways, let's go down the list. 12th, Mercedes-Benz GLS class was number 12 on the list. Number 11 was the 2024 models, was the Acura MDX. Number 10 was the Cadillac Escalade. Number 9, the Chevrolet Tahoe. 8, the Volvo XC90. 7, the Lincoln Navigator. 6, the Ford Expedition. 5, the Honda Pilot. 4, Chevrolet Suburban. 3, the Subaru Ascent. 2, the Kia Telluride. And number 1, the Lincoln Aviator. There it is, Jay. I guess it's, I don't know whether everybody wants captain's seats in their vehicle or not. Again, this is sort of a useless list for many people, unless they are up in this league of looking for this league of vehicles.
Well, I'll tell you right now, I'll take number 12 to number 1, but that, I think we're, again, comparing apples to oranges here. There's a market for large SUVs, three-row SUVs.
There's no question about it. There are more Suburbans around, I think, than most of the other ones I see, is numerically, of this list. They certainly outsell the Lincoln Navigator and the Ford Expedition. I bet they outsell them combined, the Suburban model of their GM row of big vehicles. And this includes, GMC versions as well.
So
they are indeed big. The bigger ones are very heavy. They don't get very good mileage. They apparently, according to MT's Motor Trend sort of pros and cons list, mostly drive reasonably well. They certainly carry their load that they're designed to carry probably functionally very well. A client of mine has bought a Z, I think it's a Z-something version of the Suburban, and he indeed loves it. He's got three young children. I believe his second row seat is not the captain's chairs, but he's, as he says, it carries everything in one vehicle much better than most other vehicles he's had prior to that, which usually included two vehicles on some of his trips that he traveled with his family because he couldn't fit everything into the Traverse version. But there you go. That's my section of the show
large
on
SUVs,
Motor Trends. Top 12 best in two different vehicle categories.
So the only one on the list, I'm trying to see if I've driven any, but current versions, I'd say the XC90 is the only one I've really driven. And it remains one of the top-selling large SUVs. And I want to bring this up because I have now driven three of the mid-size, full-size, luxury hybrid SUVs, and I do have an opinion on the three. And so I've driven the XC90 hybrid, which is a great vehicle, but extremely complex powertrain. It's been out since 2017, and it's powered by a both turbocharged and supercharged four-cylinder 2-liter engine. Which is a high-output engine, puts out 300 horsepower, combined with just under 100 horsepower, electric motor. And it's a great
Can you comment,
SUV.
Jay, on a combination of a supercharged and turbocharged engine as to how the supercharger benefits the turbo? Is it a lag situation?
That's the idea. That supercharger helps at lower revs. It gives it the instant torque. You know that well, as you have, I believe, at least two cars that have supercharged engines.
Correct.
And the turbocharge adds the power at, you know, once they get the turbos spooled up, gives it the power at higher RPMs. And all that in the XC90 and other Volvos is combined with an electric motor. But this is not new on the market. What is newer, and I've driven recently, and I've mentioned that, the Mercedes GLE hybrid. And it's a good vehicle, but it has also a four-cylinder engine in it, and it's definitely less powerful. But just very recently, over the weekend, I got the opportunity to drive an X5 hybrid. I think it's a 2023 BMW X5. And I have to say I had not been a big fan of BMWs necessarily in the last few years, especially when it comes to styling. That is still the case with this X5. But what an all-around great vehicle. In hybrid mode, it is totally seamless. It took me a while to realize that it was actually the inline six-cylinder
turbo in the SUV. And I think even the owner was not quite sure of that, and whether it was a four-cylinder or a six-cylinder. It definitely is a six-cylinder, inline-six. And the combined power is also 400 horsepower, and it just does everything well. And, you know, the gas mileage is somewhere in the 25, 26 miles per gallon range. So
Which is good.
It's good.
Yeah. And the electric, no doubt, contributes to that, right?
Yes. And again, this is a car I put in full electric. It doesn't get the same full electric range as the Mercedes does. It only gets about 30 miles of full electric range. But the power, again, with 100 horsepower in a very heavy vehicle, you can move around. You can move the vehicle around in almost all driving conditions, and that was what got me thinking to my earlier point about base models in electric vehicles. We don't need 500 or 600 horsepower vehicles. We just don't.
That's or 1,000 for that matter.
What's that?
Or 1,000 horsepower in any vehicle.
Or 1,000 horsepower.
And there are some out there, right?
Is the
Lucid, doesn't the Lucid have a version of a 1,000 horsepower vehicle?
Yeah.
Who needs it?
Nobody. I mean,
absolutely nobody
for the thrill. Although people who've been in a Tesla Plaid will tell you that, you know, it hurts. It physically hurts your wrist. It hurts your head. Your head when it gets slammed to the back to the headrest. So again, we've gotten into, you know, situations where we're buying vehicles that we're not using fully, nor should we. That's the whole.
Nor should we. I think that's a very good point of emphasis on that. And as I said in some recent show in the past, however recent it might or might not have been, gone is the day when 5 seconds or less, slightly less, let's say between 4 and 5 seconds to 60 miles an hour used to be a benchmark for some of the bigger vehicles with the best versions of the V8 engines that were out there. My Jaguar XJR, for example, was deemed to be somewhere between 4 and 5 seconds to 60. And let me tell you, you've driven that car. That's got plenty of power. And again, do we use even that capability often? Very little. Maybe going on to interstates, merging with the main running traffic, and or maybe to get away from a stoplight just to feel the power at that level.
I'm not suggesting we go back to 1974.
Thank you.
Speaking of your, you know, the Motor Trend 75th anniversary issue, which I do have in my hand right now, there is a comparison, and I think that the comparison is a new test. It's not just a reprint of the 1974 test, and they've compared the Honda Civic, the 1974 Honda Civic, to which the brand and the nameplate still exists. To the somewhat infamous Ford Pinto, for those of us who remember.
It was an interesting article. Continue.
Yes, and the 0 to 60 times are like one beat the other.
10 seconds or 8 seconds, whatever.
No, are you kidding? We're talking 13, 14 seconds to get to 60 miles an hour. And I guess that was pretty much if you didn't have an uphill. You know, some speed, some acceleration has provided us with some safety, actually. But again, there's a measured balance between really slow and
adequately fast.
But did you ever own a Civic or a Pinto?
I never owned a Civic or a Pinto. No.
What did you own in the mid '70s? Because you were driving, right? You can admit.
Yeah.
That.
What were the Ford models that were above the Pinto level?
Those
I forget what they are. Fairlanes or I can't remember. They had four-door sedans.
Ford Maverick.
There were four-cylinder engines back then, and they were reasonably slow, but they all were adequate, and they were for my real estate business mostly. But I can't remember exactly what they were.
Ford Granada? I
might have had a Granada or the Mercury version of that.
Yep, there's someone on the road this weekend.
And then my final Ford or Mercury appliance car of that era was the Grand Marquis, when it still had the more like the Lincoln interior to it before they homogenized it to the Crown Victoria interior, which really cheapened the look of the car, both inside and out. But those were those days.
Did you call that an appliance vehicle?
Well,
did I hear that
yeah,
correctly?
An appliance in the basis that it was used for everything that I wanted. I needed a vehicle for at that time.
Which was transporting clients around?
Correct, most of the time, yeah.
Okay, that's an appliance vehicle.
Thank you. Do you agree that it was very pleasant to have this issue, at any issue at all of Motor Trend currently in print form that you could sort of sit down in an armchair
and
read it as opposed to sitting on a computer screen as I am now trying to go through each of the articles?
Circling back to your opening statement, I think, you know, obviously auto magazines have gone the digital way like any form of news these days, and we live in a instant and live world, right?
I don't know whether Roadblock is monthly or not, Jay. Do you know?
Digital news is still, you know, the best way to go. I mean, it's obviously the only way to go. But I do remember that buying car magazines, especially when I was a kid and looking for race results and things like that, by the time the magazines came out, the news was kind of old.
Right.
But I think the print versions are great. I think a quarterly edition of a Motor Trend and can be very interesting, and certainly when you're covering, you know, 75 years of history, the print version is fun to read. Yes,
yeah.
And we have plenty of more things and vehicles to discuss.
But we have to wait until next week, I think.
I was going to say, you'll have to wait until next time. Two cars that came to mind real quick in my brain was the Gremlin and Pacer. Do you remember the Pacer?
I love those.
And we could definitely talk about them next time.
Those were some funky, especially that Pacer.
It was an upside-down bathtub. You know, it was just it was more Pinto. It was much more of that kind of vehicle than the Pinto was. And the Pinto sort of preceded that, I believe.
If you will give me two more seconds, I do want to say that over the past weekend, we had two great car shows. Here in town, we had the BMW gathering organized by FCP Euro at Lime Rock Park, and the annual Falls Village car show.
Why don't you talk about that next week's show?
Yes, it's become quite an event.
Yes, it has.
Were you at both?
I was with the trailer and the sim at Lime Rock, so I couldn't be.
That was the BMW one, right?
Later in the afternoon, so I saw the tail end of it, but there were some very cool cars, and really all kinds of older cars and collectibles. Yeah. It was fun.
Right.
It was lots of fun.
Okay.
Time for a quick safety tip, 30 seconds.
Safety tips. Kids on EV bicycles, I'll say it again. It's summer, it's nice out. You should be riding on the roads. If you're going to be riding on sidewalks, be aware that people coming out of driveways or side roads don't expect bicycles to be running at 40 miles an hour on the sidewalk.
Very good safety tip.
We all need to be more careful. And for those of us who may know kids, preaching is not the way to go, but kind of educate them on the do's and don'ts of riding around.
Good safety tip.
Car Keys with Robin Leach and Jay DeMarkin is produced at the facilities of WHDD 91.9 FM, RobinHoodRadio.com, Sharon, Connecticut.